Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Thursday, April 2024. The Speaker of Central Equatorial State's Legislative Assembly is calling for the release of Callisto Lado Nyigilo, who was abducted by armed men in Juba on Saturday.
Callisto was talking issues to do with the people of Central Equatorial State, issues to do with the land grabbing. Callisto was talking issues to do with the land grabbing. Where is the crime that Callisto has committed?
And Sudan's military leaders issued a warrant of arrest for the country's former Prime Minister, Abdallah Hamdok.
There is no system of governance in Sudan that has any type of legitimacy to actually even have the right to do or say anything about who's committing crimes. Of course, this is if there is any merit to the case itself.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The Speaker of the Central Equatorial States Legislative Assembly says individuals or a group who abducted Juba's former mayor, Callisto Lado Nyigilo, on Saturday night must release him without any preconditions. Peter Wani Elia says those holding the former mayor of Juba town have violated South Sudan's constitution.
As the representative of the people of Central Equatorial State, it is our concern. It is our concern to demand that Callisto must be released. And we will continue to echo our concern as the people representative to ensure that Callisto must be released. Because Callisto has never committed any crime at all. So why should somebody who has never committed any crime be detained? For what reason? Let the government release Callisto without any hesitation.
How would you react to people who are saying that you as lawmakers have more avenues of pressing those who have picked him to release him as opposed to writing a statement? What other tangible steps have you taken to push for his release?
As the people representative, we are calling the government, the executive, to ensure that Callisto is released. And if Callisto has committed any crime, let him be taken to the court and let the court prevail on the issue of Callisto so that Callisto is released without any problem. And this is our stand, because we are talking of freedom of expression. In the Constitution, it's clearly mentioned that freedom of expression is always there and is given to all the people to express what they want. Callisto was talking issues to do with the people of Central Equatorial State, issues to do with the land grabbing. Callisto was talking issues to do with the land grabbing. Where is the crime that Callisto has committed?
Bring us up to speed on the situation in Jebel Lado. I also saw in the statement you were talking about a situation where some young men were attacked in Jebel Lado. Could you bring us up to speed on what is happening in that area?
At the moment, there is a massive land grabbing taking place in Jebel Lado. And as a result, it has continued, and it will continue until today. The land grabbing is taking place in Jebel Lado. Even the former commissioner who was removed from the position was also talking about the issue of land grabbing in Jebel Lado. That is already, we will call it not land grabbing, but it is called, we call it a land occupation, a forceful occupation of the land of Jebel Lado. We as the parliamentarian were saying we do not want the land grabbing. If you, as an individual, you wanted the land, there must be a process. There must be a peaceful process to acquire a land, but not by force.
But who are the people who are grabbing this Jebel Lado area by force? Who are they?
The people who are taking the land in Jebel Lado, these are actually armed individuals. And these are the people in uniform. These are the people in uniform.
So when you say armed individuals, these individuals have no names. Where are they coming from?
These people are the soldiers from the SSPDF, and they are in uniform.
So you're pointing your fingers at some individuals or some errant members of the South Sudan People's Defense Forces who, in your words, are grabbing lands in Jebel Lado.
Yes.
And have you reported this to the head of the South Sudan People's Defense Forces? And if so, what was the reaction from the military?
This is something which is always happening, and it is taking place for quite a long time. The governor of Central Equatorial State issued an order of stopping the continuous land grabbing taking place in Jebelado. Government and said women went to the ground to make sure that the land grabbers are captured and arrested. The former commissioner went also to the ground and he captured some of the land grabbers. Even the current commission that we have also in Juba County, during the incident of the incident that took place and killed one young man, the commission also captured some of the land grabbers. So the issue of Jebelado land grabbing is not a new phenomenon.
You're saying nobody is taking action against the land grabbers. Who do you expect to take action?
Yes, the chief of Gera staff knows very well about that. And everybody in Juba knows what is taking place in Jebelado. But nobody is taking that action to stop it. It is left to the state. It is left to the county. It is left to Juba County. It is left to the state. Nobody in the nation is taking a step to stop the land grabbing which is happening in Jebelado.
That's Peter Wani Elia, Speaker of the Central Equatorial States Legislative Assembly. He spoke with me via telephone from Juba earlier today. Sudan's public prosecutor initiated criminal proceedings on Wednesday against former Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok, as well as other leaders from the anti-war civilian coalition, Tagaddum. Politicians, political party leaders, and journalists. The charges range from inciting war against the state to crimes against humanity, offenses punishable by death under Sudanese law. Tagaddum, which has been working to end the conflict between the Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, signed a memorandum of understanding with RSF leader General Muhammad Hamdan Dagalo earlier this year in Addis Ababa to end what is now 1 year old conflict in Sudan. Nabil Biaju reached Bakri Al-Madani, spokesperson for Tagaddum, who dismissed the charges and questioned the legitimacy of Sudan's military-led government.
Whoever this person has called the general prosecutor, I have no idea where does he get his authority. The question of legitimacy in Sudan is deep. Even Burhan or the government in Sudan is only treated as government of the day in order to avoid having a vacuum. There is no system of governance in Sudan that has any type of legitimacy to actually even have the right to do or say anything about who's committing crimes. Of course, this is if there is any merit to the case itself. Two, of course, the idea is it's a political message. We know the Islamists and the NCP always are trying to do is to completely defeat and completely vacate the political space from any democratic forces. This would make it easy for them. If there is any political settlement that is coming and there are some conversations that there might be some sort of engagement and reopening of negotiations, of course, it's going to be a lot easier for them to create some quasi-civilian bodies and coalitions and use them as a facade in order for them to come back and rule again. Basically, how do you do that? The only thing you do is you attack Tagaddum as the only game in town. I'm not saying this is the only civil society group, but it's the only active an actor and player in the political space in Sudan, actively working in the region with the international players to end the war. So basically, there is a political message. It's to label Tagaddum, to cripple it, to attack people personally, to attack their families. And the idea of opening these cases or like lawsuits is just one of the tactics. And third and lastly, by the end of the day, it has no meaning. I think it might be useful for the general prosecutor to actually claim or lay accusations against the forces that are fighting them. They are the actual one who's committing atrocities, crimes. Everyone on that list from Tagaddum, including Dr. Abdallah Hamdok, they are civilians. They are not fighting wars. We don't have camps. We are not holding hostages. We are not bombarding homes. On what grounds that would be even a case? So
that's
I think
a
it
good
is
question.
It's really...
Since the conflict started, there has been a long-standing accusation that these civilian politicians are aligned with the RSF, with the Rapid Support Forces, and working closely with General Muhammad Hamdan Dagalo to destroy the army and assume power. What do you say to that?
Of course, it's a big lie. Let me tell you one thing. NCP and the Islamic would not mind right now, at the moment I speak with you, if they can get a deal to share power with RSF, they will do it. So just imagine, if RSF is such a devilish, scary militia, and you think Tagaddum is in alliance with that militia, would you seek to have a deal with that militia. This is all political game. So reality is Taqaddum is not in a coalition or an alliance with RSF. Taqaddum is the voice of Sudanese civilian at this point, and we are stakeholders in the game. What we have been saying from day one, in order for us to stop the war, we have to engage with both sides. The belligerents, and the same ideas that we proposed to RSF for a meeting, we asked SAF, and we actually invited them to come to the table first. We thought it would be more reasonable if we can meet them first and understand their demands and take what they have, then draft a declaration of principles, and then we go to RSF. They refused. I think all of this idea of trying to label Taqaddum, this is a game fought in the media. The idea is to literally use everything, every tactic in the book, character assassination, disinformation, misinformation, and lie to Sudanese people that there is nothing called a democratic civilian forces. Therefore, create a vacuum, which means basically at some point, whenever there is a deal, as a de facto game in town is going to be the military and their alliance.
The military.
It's laughable.
And now the Taqaddum members, these civilian politicians, have these serious charges brought against them by the prosecutor general in Port Sudan. Charges like provoking war against the state, undermining the constitutional order. These are charges, as we know, under Sudanese law, carry the death penalty, meaning that you cannot return to Sudan under the current military leadership. How are you going to deal with this, and what is your next move, basically?
Let me just tell you, in terms of execution, in terms of implementing this, I have to tell you, neither Burhan nor his general prosecutor, nor anybody, there is no state, my friend, number one, to implement. If they can actually implement laws, I think they are more urgent cases in Sudan that they need to be tackled, right? They are not taking care of famines. They are not providing education. They are not providing services. They don't talk about the pain and the suffering of people. That's one. Two, I want to ask you a simple question. Do you know if there is any constitution in Sudan right now? As far as I know, I don't. The last document we have is the constitutional document developed in 2019, and the coup in October 25th basically suspended the constitution. And at this point, nobody knows, really. I'm telling you, no one knows exactly what's the legal framework for any laws in Sudan. And on that ground, I could actually question any law that anyone is going to cite. Because number one, if you don't have a constitution, you can't really talk about laws. Number two, you don't have implementing power, and the only thing you have is a political machine. So let's just put it this way. This whole thing, it's a charade for political campaign to label and to attack and to character assassinate. It doesn't mean anything. Even if we go tomorrow and say we want to go to, we are here, we want to surrender, I don't think they don't even have prisons to put someone in prison, for God's sake. So it's laughable.
That's Bakri Al-Medani, spokesperson for Taqaddum. He spoke with my colleague Nabil Biagio from Addis Ababa this past hour. A recent study by the Africa Center for Strategic Studies in Washington shows that the proliferation of disinformation is a fundamental challenge to stable and prosperous African societies. China's Africa-focused media tried to improve African perception of China and its political system while disparaging the United States. Joseph Siegler, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, discussed this with VOA's senior analyst Mohammed Al-Ashanawi.
Well, China, through the CCP, is the second leading sponsor of disinformation on the continent with 17 documented campaigns. And it is increasingly seeing the viability of disinformation. So we're seeing China do a lot more on the disinformation front in recent years. It focuses primarily in Southern Africa, and it also uses disinformation to help prop up favored regimes. We see this particularly in Zimbabwe. But the Chinese approach is more institutionalized. It tries to control information and communications technology infrastructure, signs agreements with African media houses to promote content from Chinese state-owned media. And it uses bots to amplify official Chinese statements and positions to inauthentically give the appearance of widespread support and popularity.
With the serious threat of disinformation in Africa, especially by Russia and China. How could the U.S. counter that and help African countries against such campaigns, which is using the social media outlets as a medium for spreading these disinformation campaigns?
Well, there's a number of things that can be done. I think the most important thing is to help strengthen African capacity. African actors are going to be the best representatives and actors to combat disinformation in Africa. And in the process, reestablish African agency over their information space. And so this means working with journalists, media outlets, research groups, fact checkers to help build capacity. Disinformation is becoming increasingly sophisticated. And so it takes a very particular skill set to identify it, to expose it, to report on it. But, you know, these counter-disinformation actors shouldn't have to reinvent the wheel. There's already been a lot of lessons learned on the continent, but also in Europe and in Asia, where there have been successful counter-disinformation campaigns. And so the idea is to borrow and borrow those lessons learned, apply them in Africa, and help link up networks of counter-disinformation actors so that they're seeing the common patterns of these campaigns and the tactics and the messages, and more quickly identifying them and talking about them so that they can inform and inoculate the public against them. Over the long term, this is going to require helping build up the capacity of African media, because when you have credible media outlets trusted by the population, it really helps marginalize disinformation, because citizens will go to those trusted outlets, and they aren't as easily influenced by these disinformation campaigns. And so that's going to require building up, again, the capacity and the skill sets of those managing and operating these media outlets. But it's also going to require figuring out different financing models, because so many African media outlets are just working on a shoestring. And so they're very open to taking support from some of these foreign authoritarian actors who want to usurp the message and promote their own disinformation.
That was Joseph Sigley, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. He was speaking with VOA's senior analyst, Muhammad Al-Ashanawi. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the U.S. is under fire for its weapon sales to Israel. Find out why after the break. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. U.S. weapon sales to Israel have been under increased scrutiny amid outrage over the deaths of 33,000 people in Gaza, a figure that includes 7 aid workers killed in an Israeli airstrike this week. But as White House bureau chief Patsy Widakwaswara reports, the Biden administration is showing no signs of conditioning its military support for Israel.
A ship operated by aid group World Central Kitchen left Gaza and returned to Cyprus Wednesday, its food aid undelivered after Israeli airstrikes killed 7 of the charity group's workers, including a Canadian-American dual citizen, increasing demands that the Biden administration restrict its military aid to Israel. The White House shows no signs of doing so.
We are still supporting their right to defend themselves, and we're going to continue to do that. We're also going to see what the results of the investigation is. I'm not going to get ahead of decisions that haven't been made yet.
Israel is the largest recipient of U.S. aid, nearly $4 billion a year, most of it in military assistance. Under U.S. law, the administration must notify Congress of weapons transfer to Israel that's larger than $25 million. Since the October 7th Hamas attack, Congress has been notified of 4, said Josh Paul, former director at the State Department agency that handles weapons transfers.
2 of those were under the foreign military sales system, and both of those the Biden administration used an emergency authority to set aside the regular statutory congressional notification period. 2 of them have been via the direct commercial sales process and have been notified to Congress but with less visibility because there is less information that is provided to the public on direct commercial sales.
In addition, a Department of Defense official who spoke to VOA under a condition of anonymity confirmed reporting by the Washington Post that since October 7th, over 100 arms transfers to Israel have taken place without informing Congress because the packages were structured to fall below the notification threshold.
When they are publicly saying that Israel needs to take more steps to protect civilians, but privately pushing through hundreds of millions of dollars worth of weapons, there's really no credibility when the Biden administration refuses to use the leverage that it does have. And the most significant source of leverage that the United States has is the massive amount of arms provided to Israel.
Since Harry Truman recognized Israel minutes after its founding in 1948, American presidents have supported the country almost all unconditionally, except President George H.W. Bush, who in 1991 gave Israel an ultimatum to freeze settlements on Palestinian land in exchange for $10 billion in loan guarantees. That approach worked, but not all agree that restricting aid will affect change.
The emotive issue of providing for a country's means to for their own defense can sometimes trigger different responses in different theaters. It's just been a sort of inexact tool for the U.S. in the past. And so I think that's internalized within this administration right now. And so I think that's that coupled with the president's longstanding commitment to Israel is why you haven't seen any real steps taken on this front.
President Joe Biden said in a statement he is outraged and heartbroken by the deaths of World Central kitchen workers, his latest stern rebuke over Israel's war conduct. Still, he refuses to respond to the question many are asking.
Would you consider conditioning military aid?
Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
Still in the United States, illegal immigration is the top issue for many voters in this year's U.S. presidential election. VOA correspondent Scott Stans looks at how candidates Donald Trump and Joe Biden differ over what to do.
In this week's Wisconsin primary, illegal immigration was a leading issue for many voters, including contractor Scott Lindeman.
Immigration, inflation, right to life. I would say those are the big three for me.
Lindeman voted for Republican Donald Trump before and says he will again. Trump told a Wisconsin rally that he's preparing the largest deportation in American history to rid the country of what he considers dangerous people.
They're sending prisoners, murderers, drug dealers, mental patients, terrorists. The worst of every country is coming into our country now. They're coming from the Congo, Yemen, Somalia, Syria, all over the world. They're coming. They're country changing, country threatening, and they're country wrecking. They're destroying our country.
A recent Harvard Caps Harris poll indicates immigration is the top issue for U.S. voters, with more than a third of respondents placing it above the economy, crime, and health care. President Joe Biden says immigrants contribute to the U.S. economy and are not the dangerous animals his opponent calls them.
On my first day in office as president, I introduced a comprehensive plan to fix our immigration system, secure our border, provide a pathway for citizens, for dreamers and their families, farm workers, essential workers who helped us through the pandemic and are part of the fabric of our community. Because unlike Donald Trump, I know who we are as Americans.
Trump supporters recall his 2016 pledge to build a wall at the Mexican border. If reelected, he says he'll finish the job.
With your vote, I will seal the border. I will stop the invasion. I will end the carnage, bloodshed, and killing. And we will crush the human traffickers.
A U.S. appeals court last week stopped Texas from implementing a law that would criminalize unauthorized entry into the state and allow Texas judges to order the deportation of those arrested. Biden told U.S. mayors that there's a bipartisan plan in Congress to improve border security with more immigration judges and asylum officers, as well as high-tech drug detection.
This bill would save lives, bring order to the border. It has the funds that many of our cities badly need as well. It would also give me, as president, new emergency authority, or any other president, temporarily shut down the border when a number of immigrants is overwhelming and to regain control of the border.
House Republicans objected to the bipartisan border bill, based in part on objections voiced by Trump. The Senate also failed to advance the legislation. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
Zimbabwe is attempting to turn its biggest trash dam into a source of biogas, a renewable energy source that can be used to produce electricity. Locals like the idea of a project that creates jobs and eases problems of chronic power shortages. But as Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, some residents say the project is draining the city's scarce resources.
A few months back, this dam site was an eyesore and a foul odor hung heavy in the air, but not anymore. A local company, Geopomona Waste Management, is trying to turn the site into a source of biogas and electricity. 30-year-old Tinashe Chisanu from a nearby township is one of the workers constructing the project. Shisanu says, this project is really helping me as a Zimbabwean. It has offered me a job and I'm able to look after my family. I'm really grateful to the project and I'm sure my workmates are being helped by this project too. Digesters take in organic waste and convert it to biogas, which can be used to produce electricity. Victor Tarirai is chief operating officer at the biogas company Landforce Energy in Harare.
Biogas is that it's a renewable energy source. Also, you can do many things like cooking, brooder heating, as well as harvesting an organic fertilizer, which then replaces chemical, the use of chemical fertilizers. The disadvantages, the initial investment costs, and also the need for continuous monitoring and maintenance of the digesters.
Simarashe Mchena is a waste energy engineer at Geopomona Waste Management. He says the project will end the problem of Harare's gigantic trash dumps, which spread disease.
After that, we drew biogas wells, which will extract biogas from the waste, organic waste, which was underneath, which degrades and produces biogas. Then after that, we generate, with the new waste, we generate 16 to 22 megawatts of electricity through the incineration process, whereby we have to burn the waste in a combustion chamber.
But Precious Shumba, director of Harare Residents Trust, says the government-backed project is an unsustainable exploitation of ratepayers of Harare. He says the company is charging $40 a ton for garbage delivered to the dump.
And on top of that, they have added an addendum that is requesting the city of Harare to pay an additional $124 per ton of garbage collected. So this will be exploitative to the city of Harare, as it amounts to around $3 million per month, and the ratepayers cannot afford that. Those in government who are pushing for this deal are doing it to destroy the city of Harare and not to enhance waste management in the city of Harare.
Biogas has some well-known drawbacks. Researchers say the technology used to produce it is not efficient at a large scale, and the gas tends to have impurities that can cause health concerns. But as things stand, Zimbabwe's capital will have a biogas plant sometime in coming months. Residents hope the pros will outweigh the cons. Columbus Mavungam, VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
And that report by Mavunga wraps up what we prepared for you this Thursday, April 4th, 2024. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer Chang, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Mama, come and tell me, go.
Girl, you're my only one, two. Baby, just me and you, three. Before you come to three, four step, baby, I'll be on the dance floor. Somebody, be my best somebody. Yeah, somebody, baby, need only best somebody.